Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Spencer Downing, sitting in for Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a few stories in the news. With Sunday's elections, Brazil is poised to perhaps have a change in leadership. As we'll talk to Mark Weisbrot, we'll find out why that change might not be as great as you may imagine. We'll also talk to Dahlia Lithwick for her analysis of the upcoming Supreme Court term. And we'll spend some time with Molly Lowry, who for over three decades has been working to end homelessness in Los Angeles and has some thoughts about homelessness nationwide. Now joining us is Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and the president of Just Foreign Policy. He has an article at The Guardian called Why Dilma Rousseff Could Win Brazil's Presidential Election. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Weisbrot.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So, back during that infamous game between Brazil and Germany, at halftime, one might have thought, Rousseff is never going to come out of this with any chance of winning an election. What's gone on since then?
Well, she's come back. She's got quite a lead, you know, maybe 15 points in the first round of the election. In fact, she could even win it in the first round. She needs 50% to do that. And there are some polls that put her as high as 47. So she could actually win the first round of the election. But if she doesn't, she's likely headed for a win in the second round.
And what are the ways that this has come about? What are the things that she's managed to do to rescue her political career?
Well, I think that she's actually, if you look at the campaign commercials and the things that she said on TV, it's things like if you vote for, well, the second place is Marina Silva. If you vote for her, you could lose a lot of the gains that you've had. And a lot of people seem to agree with that. You know, you've had some real changes in the nearly 12 years of Workers' Party government. You had a huge decline in poverty, 65% for extreme poverty, 55% decline in the poverty rate. So you had also, you have record low unemployment still, even though the economy is growing slowly. Unemployment is still about 5%. It was 12.3% when the Workers' Party took office. And you've had a redistribution, quite a bit of redistribution of income, 84% increase in the minimum wage in real terms after adjusting for inflation. So these changes affect not just poor people, which is, of course, tens of millions of people, but even, you know, the median household income in Brazil is only about $800 a month in U.S. dollars. And so these things, the pensions, a big increase in pensions and coverage, that really it helped a lot of people. The bargaining power of labor really shifted. That's why wages have continued to grow even into this year where there's a recession. So these are big changes in the country. And I think since Silva has right-wing economic advisors and has made statements about economic policy that are pretty right-wing, I think when the president says that you could lose things, it's believable.
Yeah, help us sort that out, because if you're sitting in the United States and you're looking at an election between the Workers' Party and the Socialist Party, with a third party that's a bit more right than both, or at least right sounding than both of them, how does that work out? It sounds on its face that that's the left and the further left, but that's not what I'm hearing from what you're...
Yeah, it does say something about the country that every major political party has the name Socialist in it, except for the Workers' Party, which is called the Workers' Party. And so it's not really a dirty word there, at least among the electorate, as it would be in the United States. But the you know, the biggest opposition party, the PSDB, the Social Democratic Party of Brazil, they're fairly conservative. So they, at least compared to the Workers' Party, they represent, and then Marina Silva, they represent, both of those candidates, Neves from the PSDB and Marina Silva from PSP represent definite parties to the right on these issues and on other issues, foreign policy issues as well. They're to the right of the Workers' Party considerably.
And do you see this as an election that gets at where there's an argument here between different visions for Brazil's future, or is this just that Rousseff's opposition has not been able to get it together?
No, I think there's very different visions. I mean, you could look at it, first of all, on these. Now, of course, they're not going to take away the Bolsa Família program, either of the two opposition candidates. You know, that's the main anti-poverty program that has really expanded under the Workers' Party. And now, it covers tens of millions of people. But what they would do, I think, they have a definitely different economic vision. I mean, Brazil, you know, Dilma comes from the left, as her predecessor, very popular predecessor, Lula da Silva, who was elected in 2002, took office in 2003. They come from the left. Both of them were jailed under the dictatorship. Dilma was tortured, and they have a long history of fighting for a much more progressive economic, more equal distribution of income and progressive economic structure of the economy, and also a different foreign policy, you know, very much more independent of the United States. And like the other left governments in the hemisphere, they also have a vision of regional economic integration, whereas the opposition tends to see things more in a neoliberal sense, less a role for the state in the economy, maybe even a free trade agreement with the United States. Silva has talked about that, a so-called free trade agreement. Distancing themselves more from their neighbors and getting closer to the United States. Those are very different visions, I think, of Brazil in both foreign and domestic policy. Yeah, I'll give you a couple more examples. Like Marina Silva was saying that she wants to cut inflation in half and lower the inflation target to 3%, which is pretty low for a developing country. If she actually tried to do that and made the central bank more independent, it's already kind of independent of the government, you would see much slower growth, much higher unemployment. It's kind of like the kind of things that, I guess the comparison would be someone like Paul Ryan and the Republicans in the United States versus the Democrats.
And at the same time, those of us who are more progressive in the U.S. can celebrate somebody who's interested in getting poor out of poverty and spreading the nation's wealth and perhaps closing wage gaps and so forth. At the same time, it seems like Rousseff is dealing with some tough issues in terms of the environment and other things that are also close to progressive hearts.
Yes. Although, I mean, they have done some things that haven't, I don't know why they haven't gotten much press. I mean, they have, according to a recent article in Science magazine, they've reduced carbon emissions more than any country in the world, mainly by cutting deforestation by 70 or 80%. So they have made some progress on some of the most important environmental issues. But, of course, not enough. And I don't see any evidence from the opposition that they would do better than that. They're not making any. Marina Silva's campaign is pretty close to agribusiness and other business interests, and her whole campaign is so much based on getting the state, the government out of economic decision making, that it's some of them want to privatize the national oil company Petrobras. So I don't see that they would be better on the environment.
Speaking of Marina Silva, another thing that has been made some discussion about is her religious beliefs. And one might say that that is just, you know, her personal thing, and she has her individual beliefs about how the world and the cosmos work. But others are suggesting that that's part of something broader that's going on in Brazil. How do you read that?
Well, there is a growing, the fundamentalist churches are growing there, and she is part of that. I think the issue where it did hurt her was on marriage equality. And, you know, that became an issue just recently when she had a celebrity endorsement from the U.S. that was Mark Ruffalo, the Hulk, had endorsed her and then publicly took it back because of her position on marriage equality. So that actually made the news and probably hurt her. That's, I think, the main issue where the religion comes in. I mean, she's also anti-choice, and that probably gets her some votes in Brazil. There's a big, obviously some of the religious vote, but I think those are the main issues.
I guess what I'm wondering, though, is this indicative of a larger swelling of evangelical power going through Latin America, as some people have suggested, or is this, well, you know, she's got her thing, and it's affects certain choices and certain opportunities for her, but it's not that big a deal.
Oh, I definitely think that's a part of her. That's a very significant part of her base, and it's a part of the kind of the electorate that has grown quite a lot. I don't know that they'll, you know, I mean, I haven't seen any good polling to see how much of that, you know, her religious base would vote for her, because a lot of them in Brazil, they tend to be poor. And if you look at the polling data on poor people, it's really overwhelmingly for the Workers' Party.
Hmm.
It's also, you know, she herself comes from a very poor background and was an activist for a long time, an environmental activist. And so she has that going for her. But again, when you ask people, I mean, you look at the polling data among poor people, even among, I mean, she's, you know, she hasn't made an issue out of it, but the press has made an issue out of her race because she is black. And, of course, that's, you know, depending on, you know, black or mixed race in Brazil is half the population. And, you know, it's not a trivial thing at all. Brazil is a deeply racist country. It's somewhat different kind of racism from the United States, but it's pretty severe. If you look at any of the statistics of poverty, for example, by race, it's pretty overwhelming. And yet the majority of black Brazilians are still voting, are not voting for her. They're voting for the Workers' Party. And that's because of the issues of progressive economic policies.
And as you see it, those progressive economic policies are likely to get a fair amount of support no matter what the outcome of Sunday's election will be.
Well, only some of them. I mean, again, if you were to have the program of either the two opposition parties and slow the economy, it would inevitably lead to cuts in social programs. They wouldn't have the revenue. So, again, they're not going to, you know, institute a huge immediate right-wing policies, but they would definitely slow the economy, have more unemployment, and then they would have to, and they would cut the budget too. So what do they cut? You know, some of the programs are going to be cut, and you know the Workers' Party has been going in the opposite direction, also expanding access to health care as well. So it would make a difference, and I think that's why Dilma has bounced back as much as she has, and will probably win.
I started off by asking about soccer. A few months ago, we were all sure that the World Cup was going to be the pivotal event for Brazil, not just during the summer, but also coming up in the elections and into the future. What's actually panned out with that?
Well, it didn't turn out to be so important. And, I mean, I agreed with some of the criticisms, obviously, in terms of the spending and with a certain amount of waste. But when you know, some of it was also exaggerated, you know, as a percentage of their budget, it wasn't really that much. And it did have some economic benefits. So I don't think it didn't turn out to be as big a deal as a lot of people thought it was going to be, even though they also lost. and it had a kind of a humiliating defeat in the games themselves. So again, I think, you know, obviously the economy is, the economy affects elections everywhere. You know, you can look at it in the United States. In fact, in the U.S., you can predict, 90% of the variance in off-year congressional elections determined by just the growth of the economy in the two quarters before the election. It's quite amazing. And you have that everywhere. But here you have a situation where the economy is actually in recession. This really should hurt her. But because I think the voters are looking at, because you've had a real transformation. I mean, think of, the U.S. after the New Deal. You know how Roosevelt was elected to four terms. It's something like that, where no matter what the economy is doing at the moment, the changes have been sufficiently large for so much of the population that they don't want to take the risk of going back to the past. I think that's what's really determining it.
In going into the future, what are you going to be looking at for the next few months in terms of Brazil, however this election results?
Well, I think that economic policy is, again, going to be key because the economy is weak. It's in recession now. It's only projected to grow by less than 2% this year, maybe even less than that. I think the government was a little bit was too conservative since 2010. You have a very powerful financial sector in Brazil. It's kind of like Wall Street here, only perhaps even more influential. And they're the kind of people, just like here, who like to drive the economy with one foot on the brake. That's the financial sector's interest. They care about inflation. They don't care so much about employment or growth. And that's true everywhere. And so I think the government has listened to them a little too much in the past, and that's why you had this slowdown in growth since 2010. And I think the big economic issue is whether they're going to change that, whether they're going to change their fiscal and monetary policy enough to restore the kind of growth they had between 2003 and 2010, which was, on a per capita basis, it was more than three times what you had in the 8 years of the prior administration. And, of course, a lot better if you go back further than that, from 1980 to 95 or into the anywhere you want to measure, you had negative growth per person basis in Brazil. So this is a real, again, if you look at the 12 years of the Workers' Party, it's a really big change in the economy. And the question is, which way are they going to go from here? A lot of the media is portraying as though the country is going to fall apart if the Workers' Party wins and they're on a road to some kind of disaster. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, I hope you're right. With that, I unfortunately have to wrap up, but thank you very much, Mark Weisbrot.
Sure, thank you.
I've been speaking with Mark Weisbrot, who's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and the president of Just Foreign Policy. He has an article at The Guardian called Why Dilma Rousseff Could Win Brazil's Presidential Election. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with Dahlia Lithwick. Welcome back. I'm Spencer Downing, sitting in for Ian Masters on Background Briefing today. Joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor and legal coordinator at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you for having me back.
Yes, it is great to talk to you here on the eve of a new term for the Supreme Court. For those of us who like to watch the Supreme Court like it's a professional sport, what are we in store for this season?
Well, there's, you know, everybody is, I guess, waiting to see if the big whammo, slammo gay marriage cases are going to be granted. It looks as though that's going to be coming down the pike, but the court had a conference last Monday where they were supposed to take up the question of whether which of the many, many same-sex marriage cases they were going to take and how many and which issues, and they still have not told us whether they're taking them or not. So everybody, I think, more or less is on tenterhooks. That's kind of the A1 story, is which appeal from which jurisdiction raising which issues if the court takes a same-sex marriage case. So we'll know more in a week, I think, about where that's going. And then there's a bunch of interesting but not nearly as dramatic cases teed up as well.
So to talk about that for a second, first off, is there any question that these folks aren't going to at least grapple with this issue? I mean, isn't this one of these pressing issues that we need? That's their job, is to figure this kind of thing out.
It's funny. I'm just in the middle of writing a piece saying just that the court has sent really mixed signals. I mean, starting with, you know, 2 years ago, or at least a year and a half ago, in the Windsor decision and the Prop 8 decision, where the court really had the opportunity, if they wanted to, you know, to go big and just once and for all say that, yes, you know, bans on gay marriage are unconstitutional, same-sex marriage is, you know, either a fundamental right or is a matter of equal protection under the 14th Amendment, you can't discriminate. And they didn't do that. They kind of went as far as they needed to go, but no farther. And they left open this question of what do we do with the state bans on same-sex marriage? And, you know, as you probably know, those cases, I mean, I think there's 42 of them now teed up. You know, we've got 7 different appeals coming up to the court, 4 courts of appeals ruling. Everybody has sort of piled on in the year and a half since Windsor and used Windsor, that ruling, to stand for the proposition that, of course, you know, if DOMA, if the Defense of Marriage Act, is unconstitutionally discriminatory, then the state bans have to fall too. And, you know, case after case, court after court has piled on to say the same thing. So in some sense, of course, it has to go to the court, because you have all these circuit courts of appeals agreeing that the bans have to fall, and yet no national ruling on it. So there is some urgency. But the court has sent really conflicting messages. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave one interview this summer where she said the court can't duck this issue. We really are going to have to get to it. And then she pivoted in September and said, you know what, we're going to wait and see what the Sixth Circuit does. That's a court of appeals that looks like it might uphold one of the bans. So she kind of made it sound as though maybe we're going to wait until there's a conflict between the appeals courts. And if they don't uphold the ban, then we're not going to be in a rush to step in, she said. So very, very ambiguous signaling from the court as to the sense of urgency around taking this right now.
And isn't that one of the real strange factors going on in this whole situation, where you have courts of appeal that are essentially in full agreement and they're outright disagreeing with legislatures, but doesn't the court normally look for the appeals courts to at least have some disagreement on an issue before they want to weigh in?
Well, that's a factor. Certainly when you have a split between, you know, federal circuit courts, the court takes that very, very seriously as a sign that it needs to be resolved at the court. But as I said, you know, this is really complicated, because each of these federal circuit courts, the minute the decision came down, as folks were about to rush out and enter into same-sex marriages, the court issued stays in all these cases. Essentially, they pushed pause and they said, we're going to leave the status quo in place until we rule on this definitively. So that kind of does two things. One, it creates a real sense of urgency. You have people around the country who want to get married, who live in jurisdictions where the court has said they can, and yet they can't because the court has stayed it. So that, I think, creates some obligation on the part of the Supreme Court to get involved because these stays remain in place until the court does anything. So I think that's one of the reasons it's just a slightly strange situation when Justice Ginsburg says we're going to wait until there's a dissenting court, because there's a dissenting, you know, Supreme Court at this point. The law of the land is not that these bans are unconstitutional. And so already you have, in some sense, a conflict. And certainly I think you have a lot of plaintiffs who feel a terrific sense of urgency that the court get to it immediately. I should say, sort of as an interesting backdrop, there's a lot of chatter in legal academia and among court watchers that sort of says, as Adam Liptak at the New York Times put it, that these cases, these marriage equality cases, come up in the shadow of Roe, and that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been really explicit about saying that although Roe was correctly decided in 1973, the court did way more than it had to. It could have limited itself to the Texas abortion statute, and that by going big and being so dramatic when the American public wasn't ready for it, in a sense, the court created the backlash to Roe. And I think Ginsburg is always very fearful of the court getting so far ahead of the country. She calls it too far, too fast in the case of Roe. And I think you're seeing a little bit of that going on, where there's some sense that, of course, it's inevitable that the court's going to get there, but they don't want to get there before we're ready for them to get there.
And we don't get a sense that we're ready simply because we have all of these laws getting passed elsewhere. But if you look at polls and so forth, it sure seems like the American public has dramatically shifted in the last 10 years. And yet you have these nine folks, or perhaps even four or five of those nine, who are saying, well, we're still not sure whether the American public is ready yet.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think that it has been so whiplash quick. The change in public opinion around this issue, the change in judicial opinion around this issue. I mean, you read both the district courts and the appeals courts' rulings on these marriage bans, you would never think that, you know, a mere 10, 15 years ago, it was unthinkable to try to challenge these bans. Now, each and every judge who writes about it, you know, is swinging for the fences and citing the anti-miscegenation laws in Loving versus Virginia, you know, as an example of how horrific and discriminatory these laws are. You know, where were these judges 10 years ago? Well, public opinion shifted. And so it is interesting. It does seem as though the country is ready. The courts are ready, state one after another. The states show that they're ready. And I should add that the arguments against same-sex marriage kind of get worse and worse as arguments, you know, are put on the table about, you know, the welfare of children, or two children need, you know, two opposite sex biological parents. And as each of those arguments gets either cast aside by the data or judges just have no patience for them, it's not as though the arguments against gay marriage are getting better. And so it's the country is changing, and also the arguments are really starting to fall apart. And so there is a question about what really are we waiting for at this point. I think we're ready for the court to pull the trigger, but I think there is terrific anxiety, at least on the part of some of the members of the court, that they not create some kind of, you know, thermonuclear backlash that redounds really to the harm of gay rights around the country for decades to come.
Which I think is a very generous interpretation, at least for some of those people on that court. Now, I want to ask you about a different thing. You've mentioned Ruth Bader Ginsburg a couple times. What's up with RBG?
I think she's having the time of her life. You know, she has been, you know, she's 81 years old. I think she could bench press more than you and I put together. I mean, she has become this kind of cult figure, and never more so than this summer. She wrote an absolutely blistering dissent in the Hobby Lobby case, the case about whether for-profit corporations could have religious conscience as people, objections to the contraception mandate in the healthcare, in the Obamacare, and she wrote this just searing, searing dissent. And there are tumblers, you know, notorious RBG tumblers and T-shirts, and suddenly, you know, in interesting ways, young feminists around the country are looking at this 81-year-old, probably 81-pound lady and saying, you know, she represents the sort of height of my feminist aspirations. It's amazing, and I think she has decided to respond to that by giving, you know, interview after interview, talking, you know, to any reporter, I think, that seeks an interview, and giving very, very, I would say, strongly felt and passionately felt comments about the court, about how the men on the court just don't get it, about how, you know, she just plain out said that the reason the court has kind of fallen way, way behind on reproductive issues is because of Anthony Kennedy. So she's really putting it all out there, and it's been a sort of strange summer watching her in many ways at the height of her game at the same moment that a lot of folks are calling on her to retire.
Yeah, let's think about that for a minute. A lot of folks are saying she's 81 and she is the progressive voice on the court right now. We have a perhaps maybe progressive president. Perhaps we need to get somebody locked in before Obama gets out of office. And she said, no, I'm not going.
Right. There were a couple of very prominent academics who publicly in the last year, I think they would probably stipulate now it's just too late because we're too close to the midterms. But about a year ago, a bunch of folks went on the record just saying she needs to step down, she needs to do it now. Many of them swept in Stephen Breyer, who's 76, also a sort of member of the court's liberal wing, and simply said, you know, you've got to give Obama a chance to fill these seats. He can put someone on the court who could sit for 30 years, and, you know, you have maybe 2-3 years left. And, you know, in Ginsburg's case, they cite to the fact that she's a cancer survivor. So I think that the sort of pragmatists on the academic left in the legal community just really pushed hard to say you are imperiling, you know, on a 4-4 court with Justice Kennedy, who's very conservative, seen as the swing vote, you are imperiling, you know, truly, truly constitutional, you know, change in the country, and step down. And she has just dug in. She's made it plain to anyone who asks, and now everybody is asking, that she's not going anywhere, and that she thinks that she has years left to serve, and she feels really strongly that if liberals are worried about the court, then they should get out and vote and make sure that, you know, the next president appoints someone like her. But she has, you know, really gone to the mat on this issue. And in fact, in a recent interview in Elle magazine, she simply outright said, nobody's going to put anyone like me on the court. You know, you're not going to get another me. So enjoy me. And she's been kind of notorious about it. She's almost rapper-like herself.
And she, like you say, she's not pulling any punches here, and she's been very, very vocal about what she thinks about what the court has been doing in the last few years with some of their decisions, you know, in as nice a way as one does to remain collegial in that building. But she's essentially saying this court is making some huge errors, and she's recently come out with saying that Citizens United was the worst decision. And when you dovetail that with folks like Erwin Chemerinsky's new book, that is a pretty solid indictment of the court. You've got 10 years of the Roberts Court building on the Rehnquist Court. What do you make of that? And maybe a way to think about that is, how is this court going to be thought of in law schools 50 years from now?
Well, I think that, you know, for one thing, I would strongly recommend Professor Chemerinsky's book. It's called The Case Against the Supreme Court. I think this week was the pub date, and it's a really thoughtful indictment, not just of the Roberts Court, I think it's fair to say, of the court generally, even the Warren Court. You know, he just feels that the court isn't brave, it doesn't do the work that it's tasked with doing, which is protecting minorities from tyrannical majorities, and that time and again, over, you know, two centuries, the court has simply failed at that. But I think he points out, and I think this is true, that the Roberts Court is truly empirically, I think this is proven by study after study, the most conservative court since we've had, since the New Deal era. I mean, there are studies that show that four of the most conservative jurists in the last 100 years are sitting on the court right now. And it's dramatic. And we see, and I think this goes to your question, that as, you know, Brennan's and Blackman's and Marshall's retired, they're replaced by people to their right. But as Rehnquist's and O'Connor's retire, they are also replaced with people to their right. And so inexorably, I think we've seen over the last few decades, the court, the center of the court, what was the center of the court, is now the left of the court. And what was at the right wing of the court is now considered moderate, and then you have this extremely right-wing wing of the court that really was unheard of for most of the last century. And so the court has just simply torqued quite dramatically rightward. And I think that even Chief Justice Roberts said in a speech 2 weeks ago that it is inconceivable to him that a Scalia or a Ginsburg could get confirmed today in this incredibly toxic and ideological climate. And Ginsburg has said many, many times that, you know, I was an ACLU lawyer. You're not going to get another ACLU lawyer confirmed. And whoever, you know, Obama or the next president puts up will be to her right. And I do think that, you know, the court has moved and moved and moved rightward. And I think that the American public is probably not aware. You know, we are sort of aware of these bullet points. You know, No Citizens United happened, and we know, you know, McCutcheon happened this year, and we know Hobby Lobby happened. But I think that trend of, you know, the center of the court is a very conservative place to be. I think not all Americans have quite cottoned on to that yet.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg 15 years ago would be mildly astonished to be thought of as the far left of the Supreme Court. And yet the court has moved so far right that she seems to be out there waving red flags or something like
and,
that.
And Justice Stevens before her. I mean, he very openly says when he came onto the court, he was center. And over the years, it's not that, you know, when he's asked, did you move to the left? He says, I didn't move to the left. The court moved around me. And I think there's some real truth in that.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, we will look forward to seeing what happens with the court during this term. And thanks for letting us see some of what we're in store for.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who is senior editor and legal coordinator at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. You should check out her blog. It's well worth reading. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back talking with Molly Lowry. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Spencer Downing, sitting in for Ian Masters. Now joining us is Molly Lowry, the Executive Director for Housing Works in Los Angeles. She's also a founder of LAMP Community in Skid Row in Los Angeles, and she's been a long-time, decades-long advocate for people experiencing homelessness, especially folks who deal with mental illness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Molly Lowry.
Thank you.
Molly, when you talk about homelessness, so often people feel like there's no news in homelessness. It is. It exists. It's always going to be with us. And yet, on the other hand, communities like ours are being asked to accept this idea that chronic and veteran homelessness will end by the end of 2016. As you see it, what's going on with homelessness, Molly?
Well, it's a whole lot more complicated than ending it in 2016. I've said to a few folks that I think the only way we're going to end homelessness in 2016 is by renaming it. So it's been with us. What we call homeless people have been with us for going on 40 years, and it's a part of our whole society. We count them in our census, so they become a fixture, not a crisis, and that is deplorable. The largest percentage of people who are homeless are people with very serious mental illness. Why are they homeless? Mostly because we don't have a mental health system that effectively treats people or even is accessible to homeless people. They can't even get in to be treated if they were wanting to do so. And then the treatment is ineffective. You can't diagnose a person with schizophrenia and send them on their way with a prescription, and on their way is going back out on the streets, and expect them to be able to follow a regimen of taking medications. And taking medications is only one tool in a very large toolbox of treatment for mentally ill people. But poor and homeless folks, they only get the treatment of medications. They don't get therapy. They don't get any kind of holistic treatment that could be very helpful for them. And so they suffer out there, and they go further and further into their mental illness and get farther and farther away from a reality that most of the rest of us experience. It's very frightening, very stressful. So that population of people that are out there, we have failed them. We have failed them for all these years by not giving them what they need and what they can tolerate, by not caring about them enough to do anything.
And that is one of the odd things about all of this, is that we are living in the wealthiest nation in human history, and yet we can't seem to provide some of the very basics for some of the most vulnerable people around us.
That is very true. Our values are pretty screwed up. You know, we can come up with millions and billions of dollars to go into foreign wars and create havoc, but we can't build enough housing for people or offer and provide mental health services and substance abuse treatment for our folks. It's twisted. You know, as you know, the drug war is costing us so much more money than we're putting into drug treatment. So our people with severe health conditions, including addiction, are rendered to be marginalized on our streets without any treatment and furthering their illness. Those are the values we have.
And arguably our systems reflect our values. And if we're going to change anything, it seems to me that changing some of those systems is going to be absolutely essential. I don't know. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah. I would love to have a way to literally turn some of our mental health treatment systems and our substance abuse treatments upside down, and the prison industrial complex upside down. That's where most of our mentally ill and addicted folks are. They're not on the streets. They're in prison, where we've spent so much money to build more and more of them and continue to neglect actual treatment, which would help people become productive citizens in our world rather than very, very sick people living on sidewalks.
You've been doing this for a while. What kinds of things have you seen change over time with these kind of systems? Do you see that there's actually been shifts, or has it just managed to get worse and more exacerbated in terms of these kind of machinery that generate homelessness?
Well, I can only speak for Los Angeles. There are some cities who are doing a whole lot better at providing for the needs of poor people. So I'll speak to Los Angeles. Yes, for 45 years I've been doing this work. And what I experience is some thrilling times when we're all getting excited about a change in how we're approaching. Like, instead of approaching mental illness, we're going to talk about it as people who can recover from their mental illness. And our whole mental health system is going to change to a recovery model rather than a sick model. it's language. It's good language, and you get excited hearing that that's actually going to happen and there's actually money put into it. But ultimately, it doesn't change. The words change, but how things are done does not change. The treatment provided doesn't change. So that's a very sad situation. And certainly with addiction, substance abuse treatment, all we've done over these many years is spend more money on the drug war, trying to keep drugs from coming into this country, which will never stop that. We're a drug-using society. And poor people who have to do some pretty crappy things in order to sustain their drug habit are stuck out there and are criminalized for a health condition. We're not setting up new treatments. We're not setting up recovery homes. We're setting up and fighting a drug war. There are some harm reduction models, which we are also involved in, but this country has really limited it to just needle exchange, whereas other countries like Portugal and Canada are way, way, way ahead of us in treating addictions as health issues and really helping people manage their use and really become healthy, productive people in the world. We're so far away from that. We're still so into criminalizing them, which puts them on the street. And, you know, as long as we don't have effective treatment and as long as we criminalize people, we're going to have a very, very large homeless problem because we marginalize them. They have no access to housing once they have a criminal record.
And I know that this is one of the things that you're really interested in, is this relationship between drugs and substance use and mental illness and criminalization, and how all of these seem to work in the United States toward pushing especially poor people who are already among the most vulnerable into these super vulnerable positions, living on the street where their illnesses get worse, their addictions get worse, and their ability to get into housing just become even more limited.
Correct. Exactly.
So what does that look like to rethink the way that we think about substance use and we think about these issues that we now criminalize? What does that actually look like? How does that change in our thinking?
Well, there are solutions being worked on. I mean, we're very involved with getting people off the street using housing first, which just basically means that despite you're using drugs or despite the fact that you're acutely mentally ill, we want to work with you to get into some permanent housing that you'll have some control over. You'll have a lease. You'll be paying rent. So you're going to have some responsibilities, but at least you'll have a home. And once you have a home, we're going to keep working with you to help you make some hard decisions for your life, you know, to have you care enough about yourself to do something about your mental illness and your addiction and your other health issues, you know, because we really want you to succeed. We want you to make it and thrive in our community. We want you to be participating and not be marginalized. And so it's housing first, just literally helping people get immediately into housing. And then what we call permanent supportive housing, which means, you know, once they're in housing, an agency like ours, we continue to connect with them and provide them supportive services and help them move along on their journey to recovery. You know, we all need some help and support in our lives. We usually get it from family and good friends. You know, the folks that have been homeless for very long don't really have that support system. They have to build it from inside. And so that's what we help them do. So we know there's ways to make this work. We know there are ways to get people off the streets and help them stay off the streets. And it's one person at a time. We can't do it in rapid fire, huge volumes. There aren't the resources out there to do it. But we can do it one person at a time and get them invested in doing it and helping their friends out and building a family. So that's optimism, that we actually know what works. Now we've just got to get the policymakers and the elected officials to value those people enough to provide the resources to do it.
And
one of the things that's really interesting, Spencer, that I think most people know at this point, is that it's much more expensive to keep people on the street than it is to get them housed in permanent supportive housing. You know, it's thousands of dollars difference, because when they're on the streets, they tend to have to use these emergency systems like emergency rooms, in and out of jails, and all the stuff that come with being marginalized out there. It costs our systems so much more money to keep people cycling through them than it would if they had a home and were able to start taking care of themselves in more appropriate ways.
You know, I think, Molly, I think that seems to me like a regular part of our lives. Listeners, Molly and I both work with homelessness on a daily basis, but I'm not so sure that that's commonly understood. I think people think, oh, if a person's living on the streets and they're not paying rent and they don't have a job, well, they're probably using up, you know, a few thousand dollars worth of stuff a year between panhandling and whatever small benefits they might get. I don't think most people conceive of the hundreds of thousands of dollars that go into all of the stuff that come around, you know, just the sheer amount of time that people who live on the streets spend in jail, the amount of public resources that get sucked up into that useless endeavor. Yeah, it's
exactly.
And at the same time, it's an odd thing, because it seems like this is one of those places that's so unusual where people who care about human beings might possibly come into agreement with people who only care about the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Are you finding that to be the case, that you actually are able to appeal to folks who you might have huge political disagreement with?
Oh, yeah. No, once people started putting this equation together, showing that it costs a whole lot more to keep Joe Schmo on the street than it does to house him, we've got a lot of interest in that, because that saves money, and that's the bottom line. You know, all my years, I was saying, this is immoral. We can't do this. This is inhumane to have people living on our streets in this rich world, in this rich society. You know, and finally people told me, Molly, that isn't going to get you anywhere. What's going to get you somewhere is showing that the bottom line, their wallets are going to be fatter if we get these people off the street. That's what matters, you know, and I hate it, you know, but that's it.
That's how you have to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to talk about things that were broad systems kind of changes, what sorts of things would you like to see done if you could get the levers of power to move these immovable agencies and the American willpower to spend tax dollars differently? What kinds of things would you love to see happen?
Definitely, we need a whole lot more affordable, available housing, you know, that people can live in. And we have to get the housing and urban development on the federal level to have the resources to be able to build that housing and make it the kind of housing that really gives us a sense of community and belonging. You know, we know the big, huge housing projects back from the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, they didn't work. They were just these huge places where people were just crammed into them. So we know better. So building housing that's accessible, that is community-based, and is affordable is a major part of it. And then we need the surrounding supports for people who do have special needs, who are trying to live in our communities with mental illness, who need treatment. They need options for helping them cope with their mental illness, manage it. We have to have that at the same time as having the housing that's available to them. And I know that we need to do a lot of educating, because people are still very frightened of people with mental illness, particularly when we have the shootings that are often attributed to somebody with mental illness. You know, so that just makes people more frightened of having them in our communities. But there's an awful lot of those people, and we know that treatment can work. We've just got to make it available.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's hard to remind people is that if you've actually watched the transformation in a person who's come off the street and is managing to cope effectively and get what treatment is necessary and sometimes go beyond needing treatment in the same way, it's a pretty remarkable transformation and pretty satisfying. And when you start off an interview hearing about how horrible it can be to work with homelessness in America, it's easy to forget that there actually is some cause for some hope.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, some folks, as I know you've experienced, if you get them into housing and it's a safe, decent environment, just that alone reduces a lot of the symptoms of mental illness because they're not stressed out. I mean, all of us have experienced alterations in our sense of place and center and reality when we're stressed. So imagine somebody who's got a mental illness as a challenge and they're living in very stressful, isolated conditions on the street where every day is a day to survive, you know, and they're being taunted and really completely devalued as human beings. And to live that way 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without proper rest and proper nutrition and all of that stuff, it, as I mentioned earlier, makes them very, very sick. And just changing that environment, we see a huge change in how the person responds to their world and to people, all right? Take that and add some holistic types of treatment where they have some choice around what treatment they get and that it's available to them and that they're able to develop really good constructive relationships with their health and mental health providers. You got it. There's the formula. It's there. Yeah?
And it can work.
Yes.
Well, Molly,
and give them something valuable to do with their life.
Yeah.
You know, that's a whole other issue is employment or how people can contribute because they want to contribute.
Yeah. Well, Molly, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you so much for talking with us today.
All right. I enjoyed this. Thank you.
Okay. We've been speaking with Molly Lowry, who's the executive director for Housing Works, which is an agency in Los Angeles. She's also one of the founders of LAMP Community, which is in Skid Row in Los Angeles. And she has, for more than 30 years, been working as an advocate for people who are experiencing homelessness. You've been listening to Background Briefing. I'm Spencer Downing, sitting in for Ian Masters. I'd like to thank Graham Fitzgibbon for his work on production. Be sure to check out Ian's site at ianmasters.com, and you can also follow him on Facebook. Tune in tomorrow when Jessica Levinson will be sitting in for Ian. Until then, bye-bye. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.